Good. So we are on Ayin Hey Amud Beis, 75B, and hopefully people got the source sheets that I sent out. Byron, I resent it to your new address about 15, 20 minutes ago. Did it come through? Sorry?
I got it.
You got it. Okay, wonderful. I'm relieved to hear that. Okay. If anyone here has a simpatico email address, then you may not be getting various emails of mine for reasons unknown to me. Okay, then. We are, as I said, on Ayin Hey Amud Beis. We are on 75B. I can welcome an Allentonian, Clive. Thank you for chiming in here. So we are in a discussion about kashering kalim. Kashering, tovling kalim specifically. So I'm going to share the screen so that people can look at the same page that I am looking at here in our Gemara. And going down a little bit, we had gone through the opening piece of Gemara here in which we traced the source for Tevilas Kalim, for the idea that when you get utensils from someone who isn't Jewish, whether they've used them or have not used them doesn't make a difference, they have to go to the mikvah. We quoted the Yerushalmi last time. The Yerushalmi said that the idea is that that they are essentially becoming Jewish. You are removing them from the tumah, the impurity that they had, and they are now entering into Jewish use. And the fact that we brought psukim, we brought passages from the end of the book of Bamidbar, like the one that I'm pointing to here on the page, called the Shevo Ba'esh, Tavir Ba'esh B'Taher, whatever you pass through fire, should go through fire. And then we went on to talk about the main Nidah, that it has to be passed through this main Nidah, which we understood to be the mikvah, made it sound like it's a deoraisa, made it sound like this is a biblical rule. And I think where we actually left off was not in this, but was in the source sheet that I sent out, which I'm also going to open up on my page so that I'll be able to share that as well. That's going to just take moving a couple of things around. But I know not everybody may have this in front of them. So I'm going to share the source sheet. And which one is it? Oh, there we go. Okay. So is the source sheet now up? You can see that on your screen? Instead of the Gemara, did that work?
Yes.
Yes? Okay, great. So where we had left off was what you see here for source base, the Rambam, and I translated it as well in the hope that that would make it a little more clear, because the Rambam's language is not entirely clear. But what the Rambam says is, and I'm reading out my translation, this is immersion, this, Tevilas Kalim, is immersion of meal implements acquired from Akum, acquired from idolaters. And Chuck, we noted it doesn't just mean idolaters, it means people who aren't Jewish in general. So that they, the utensils, may then be used for eating and drinking. He says it's not about Tumah and Tahara, this is not about the usual laws of purity and impurity, but rather it's Midivrei Sofrim. He calls it Divrei Sofrim. Divrei Sofrim, literally, words of the scholars, possibly words of the scribes, but remember that the word Sofer can often mean a scholar, not necessarily a scribe. People think that when you talk about Ezra, as Ezra HaSofer, that means Ezra the scribe, and he did have a scribal role. But hold on one second. I'm just going to mute everybody by default. You can still unmute yourself, but that way whatever it is that's in the background there will not be a distraction to everybody. Now I'll go back to sharing that screen. There we go. So the Rambam says that this law of immersing utensils is midivrei sofrim, from words of the scholars or words of the scribes. A hint to this is, and he quotes the verse that we read, all that enters fire, you shall pass through fire, and it will be pure. By tradition, we have learned that it only speaks of their purification from the aquam's absorption. When it talks about passing the utensils through fire, it's talking about purifying them from whatever food it absorbed, not from impurity, because impurity does not leave via fire. All that is tameh leaves its tumah via immersion. If something is tameh, it stops being tameh if you immerse it. And since it says, it shall be pure, the sages said, add purification after it passes through fire to permit it from the aquam's absorption. There's an additional layer of purification. Now, what we noted at the very end last time, and I ran through it then, and I don't intend to spend more time on it now, is that it sounds almost like the Rambam is saying, you only immerse a utensil if it had the aquam's absorption, if it actually absorbed non-kosher food. In the event that it was never used for non-kosher food, I wouldn't need to immerse it at all. But that's not what the Rambam is saying here. The Rambam is talking about it in all cases, and I brought the Lechem Mishnah last time who says so. But the key question is the Rambam trying to tell me that immersing utensils is actually a rabbinic law and not a biblical one? So there are major ramifications to saying that. If you really believe that this is rabbinic, then, for example, if I'm not sure whether immersion is required, if it's of a type of material that I'm not sure needs immersion, or if I'm not sure maybe it was already immersed, then I won't need to immerse it, because it's safek derabbanan, it's doubt on a rabbinic matter. So the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, indeed said that the Rambam believes that immersing utensils before eating with them is rabbinic. That's the position of the Rashba. We're actually going to come back to that a little bit later. That's going to matter in our conversation. However, others disagree and say, no, the Rambam believes that immersing is a biblical obligation. He called it divrei sofrim, the words of the scholars or the words of the scribes. Doesn't that mean that it's rabbinic and not biblical? So take a look on the sheet that I'm still sharing with you. It's source Gimel. This is from the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvos, his book of the Mitzvos, specifically his introduction, where he gives you certain rules about what counts as one of the Torah's 613 Mitzvos, right? It was a great sport in the Rambam's day. The Gemara says that there are 613 mitzvahs, but it doesn't tell you at all how to calculate them. And the truth is that if you were to ask me to count up the 613 mitzvahs, I would end up with many, many more than 613. There's a whole lot you can do to come up with way more than 613. So the Rambam comes up with rules for which things are in and which things are out. And what I have here for you in source Gimel, the third source, is he says, Koma sheyotzi adam hema nafim en asharashim shenemru lo Moshe b'sinai b'be'ur ve'im tarag mitzvos. He says, all that people produce via the levels of deduction from biblical text, all of them are branches that come off of the roots that were told to Moshe at Sinai, and those are the 613. Vafilu hayahamotzi Moshe ba'atzmo ein roilim nosam. But he says, the things that you are deducing aren't the 613. It's only what Moshe got directly at Sinai that is the 613. And therefore, he says, even if Moshe himself were to deduce something, it wouldn't count in the 613. Whatever comes by deduction is not in the official count. Kikoma shaloshamu b'Sinai b'Be'ur. Here's the key phrase. Whatever they did not hear explicitly at Sinai, humi divrei sofrim, is called divrei sofrim. So in other words, what the Rambam is saying here, and I'd rather be able to see people so I can tell whether people are confused enough or whether I still have more to do to confuse you. What the Rambam is saying here is that he's not willing to count in the 613 that which is learned by deduction from biblical verses. So when you have a Gezeirah Shavah, for example, right, the text uses this word here and uses that word there, and from that I'm going to learn. He says, that's not in the 613. However, it is biblical. It's just not in Tarjag Mitzvos. It's not in the 613. The 613 are things that God told Moshe explicitly. Doesn't matter if something's in the 613 or not. And that's really, you know, the thing that people have to wrap their heads around. Well, if it's not in the 613, then it's not legitimate, right? You know, sort of like there are people who believe if it's not in the Big Ten, right? It's not in the Ten Commandments, then, all right, so it's not as important as the Ten. Not true. If it's not in the Big Ten, it's still important. And if it's not in the 613, it's still important. The 613 are deduced in the Gemara. Rabbi Simlai says it in the Gemara at the end of Makos, because Torah tziva lanu Moshe, right? Moshe commanded us Torah. The gematria of the word Torah is 611. There were two commandments stated by God explicitly to the Jews himself. So Moshe gave us 611. God gave us two. And I can do math. 611 plus 2 equals 613. So those are the things that were commanded to us explicitly. The others, derived. Still biblical. So that's the way that others take what the Rambam is doing here. The Aruch HaShulchan says that's what the Rambam was trying to do. And I'm going to go back to sharing, unless somebody has a question first, I'm going to go back to sharing the Aruch HaShulchan so you can see how he explained this within the view of the Rambam. Questions first, or are we good?
Does that mean that we hold that dipping a kikli in a mikveh is derbanan?
No,
or is that just the Rambam's opinion? Or is that just the...
That's the Rashba's view of what the Rambam is saying.
Right, so that doesn't mean we accept that.
Everybody else holds Del-Raisa.
Right, because otherwise it would be something derbanan.
The Gula, correct. Correct.
And that would... Right.
You got it.
Okay, so we hold it, it's derisa.
Correct.
Does the Rambam have separate categories for the different types of tefillah that are needed, or is it ballistic? It's like one...
What do you mean?
Well, does he have he's saying one mitzvah, let's say, is to toivel one type of plea, and the other is another mitzvah to toivel another type of plea? Or is it just...
No, I think it's all one. It's all one, and it's not in the 613. Yeah, that's the way that the Rambam does it. I'll share with you what the Aruch HaShulchan does here. It's in Source Dalet, and again, what I did was I brought you the Hebrew, and then I gave you my English translation, because the Hebrew is a little dense. And I'm going to stick with my translation here, which I see a typo in. Sorry about that. The Rambam writes, in my humble opinion, it appears that the Rambam was troubled, right? The Rambam, when he stressed, it's actually mi divrei sofrim, that it's not straight biblical, but it's divrei sofrim, whatever that means, which again we're trying to understand. The Rambam was troubled by the Talmudic deduction from the extra, and it will be purified. Meaning, our Gemara said, the way I know about toveling all begins with the fact that the Torah says, vitaher, and it will be purified. And the Rambam was bothered by that fact that you're learning something from the words, and it will be purified. Because, as Rabbi Chil Michal Epstein, the Aruch HaShulchan continues, throughout the Torah, laws of purification are followed by, and it will be purified. Like, and the Aruch HaShulchan gives you a bunch of examples, which I didn't bother to translate, but I'll scroll up so those who have the Hebrew can see it. V'chiper aleh ha-kohen v'taher. V'chiper aleh ha-kohen v'taher. V'rachaz b'sor b'mayim chayim v'taher. U'ba shemesh v'taher. So many different times the Torah is talking about a purification process, and it concludes, v'taher, it shall be purified. So the Rambam was bothered. Why now are we suddenly making the statement that these words of Vitaher are superfluous, when the truth of the matter is that they appear all the time in the Torah and no one ever bats an eyelash? So the Rambam said, therefore, the Talmud answered that certainly, had the Torah been dealing with impurity and purity, with those laws about Tumah and Tahara, then writing, and it will be purified like everywhere else, would have made sense, because the Torah does that all the time. But here they learned from tradition that it was only speaking about non-kosher absorption. And therefore the word vitaher, and it will be purified, is superfluous. If we were talking about purity and impurity, vitaher would be in place. It's because we're not that vitaher is extra. And once that's there as something extra to teach me, wait a minute, something else is going on, dip it in the mikvah, now he has somewhere to go. There is support for this from the fact that we never see impurity depart via fire. That was the Rambam's point. And if so, what is the language of, and it will be purified? What is the Gemara trying to do? What are we trying to deduce from the words, and it will be purified? Rather, certainly it refers to immersion in a mikvah. As for this, purification is relevant. Here, purification is relevant as seen in the Yerushalmi. As we saw in the Yerushalmi, that he removes it from the impurity of the Egyptians to the sanctity of Israel. What you're doing is a different kind of purification. What the Aruch HaShulchan is trying to tell you here is that the word vitaher is understood to be superfluous because we're not dealing with purity and impurity. But that deduction is a divrei sofrim deduction. And that's what the Rambam is trying to tell you. I wouldn't have known that from the straight text. That's a deduction. And so that's what the Rambam wants to show you, but he's not trying to say it's rabbinic. Parenthetically, I know at least one person here noticed the Aruch HaShulchan said, you're toveling it, you're immersing it in order to move it from the impurity of the Egyptians, right? Which was not a word you saw in the Yerushalmi. Why did the Aruch HaShulchan talk about the impurity of the Egyptians? What does that have to do with Egyptians? These vessels came from Midian. Why did he mention Egyptians? Tell me something. How many Egyptians do you think the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Chil Michel Epstein, who was the rabbi in Novarduk at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, how many Egyptians do you think he ever met? Yeah, I'm with Harry. Somewhere around zero, you know, give or take three. So what is this business with Egyptians? And the answer is, the Aruch HaShulchan is dealing with censors. That's the Aruch HaShulchan's world. Because he's in, again, Lithuania, the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, he's dealing with censorship. The government gets a hold of a document which says that we have vessels which we bought from people who weren't Jewish. They need to go to mikveh now to be removed from the impurity of our non-Jewish neighbors, right? So that Jews who are holy can use them. How long do you think that manuscript survives? How long do you think its author survives? So that's why what he's doing is a little bit of misdirection by saying it's removing them from the impurity of the Egyptians. That's why I need to tovel the silver that I got from my Lithuanian neighbor. That's what the Aruch HaShulchan is doing. It's not only here. He uses Egyptians on other occasions as well. Okay. That's what, yeah.
You're referring to the kaling that they took out of the Mibar, out of Egypt?
No, he's referring to from the war with Midian. It's clay Midian. Right. Has nothing to do with vessels they took out of Egypt. Anything they took out of Egypt was...
They would need to be lost after Mamre Harsinai, I know.
So there you run into a very interesting question. Would the utensils they took out of Egypt have needed to go to mikveh before you could use them? It reminds me of the question of somebody who converts to Judaism, right? Do they need to now immerse their utensils? The answer is yes. Their vessels now need toveling. That's why whatever they took out of Egypt needed toveling, because the Jews as a whole converted to Judaism at Har Sinai. That's really why you would need it. Not so much because it came from Egypt. The Jews weren't Jewish until then. I would think that would be the reason why. But yeah, that's not what he's doing here. He's not alluding to that. If you want, I can send you some other references where the Aruch HaShulchan uses the word Mitzri. This is not the only case. Okay, so all of that is just wrapping up from the end last time. Let's go a little ahead in the Gemara and see more about this business of toveling kalim. So we are, let's see, at Rav Nachman. Yeah, here we are. Amar Rav Nachman. If you see where the arrow is on the page, can people see that? Okay. I'll move it up a little further. It'll be the top of the screen. Okay. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rabba Bar Avua. Rav Nachman said, quoting Rabba Bar Avua, he's going to actually say two things quoting Rabba Bar Avua. This is his first one. And it's going to tell us what types of utensils have to go to mikveh. He says, Afilu kelim chadashim b'mashma. Even brand new utensils have to go to mikveh. They've never been used. I bought it off the shelf at the store. Doesn't make a difference. That has to go into the mikvah as well. How does he know that? Where did he get that from? Because if I had old utensils, used utensils, and then I fired them up, I took a blowtorch to them, they would now be as though they were brand new, and yet you still have to immerse it. So clearly, even though, you know, if libun, if making it, you know, white hot, is insufficient to say, now I don't need to take it to mikvah, obviously the goal of mikvah is not getting rid of whatever food was absorbed in it. It has nothing to do with food absorption at all. It's a rule that their utensils, new or old, need to go to mikvah. So maskifla Rav Sheshes. Rav Sheshes says, oh, that's interesting. That's really interesting. Tell me something. If it's not about food, then why do you keep talking about toveling things that are used for food? Ihachi, if that's true, if so, afilu zuza desarvel anami. The same thing should be true for scissors that you use to cut wool. Right? If I have shearing scissors, those should also have to go to mikvah. Why are you limiting the conversation specifically to things that are used for food? Omar lay, to which you get the response from Rav Nachman, klei seuda amurin b'parsha. The Torah only speaks of klei seuda, utensils that are used with a meal. How does he know that it's utensils that are used with a meal? Where did he get that idea from? Did you see anything at all in the Gemara that said it had to be utensils that are used for a meal? All it said was, whatever you brought back that's made of metal, whatever goes through fire, put through fire. Whatever goes through water, put through water. Where did it say anything about these being clay seuda, utensils that are used for a meal? Where did Rav Nachman get that idea from? What would you say?
It makes sense that it should be only clay kaolin they use for meals, because that's, you're only worried about, like, with things like scissors, you know, there's no worry about eating in them. You know, the only things you're eating from there, you're worried that the tummy's going to be affect your food. Or, you
know, why? Why is there any tumma at all? I already took a blowtorch to it. There's no food absorbed. There's no nothing.
I know. So we said that you said it's like a goy going to the mikvah.
Yeah.
So
maybe scissors need to become Jewish. All right. It feels like that Hasidish story, right? The fellow with the spoons. Right? The spoons that multiplied? You know what I'm talking about. I don't remember the whole story. Someone here must know this story. About the guy who borrowed spoons? It goes vaguely like this, that there is some guy who borrowed silver spoons from somebody else. And he borrowed like 5 spoons. He said, we're having a big feast and I need more settings. So he borrows 5 spoons. And then he comes back to the fellow who lent him the spoons. And he says to him, you know, you'll never believe it, but those spoons that you lent me, they actually had baby spoons. And now here are your spoons back, and here are the babies. There are now 8 spoons. Leave aside the ribbis conversation. Yes, there's interest, that's a problem, but this is a story. So he gives him the extra 3 spoons, and he says, here, now you have 8 spoons. Mazel tov. Guy's very happy. 6 months later, fellow says, comes back to him and says, you know, again, I'm having a feast. Laser remembers the story now. He says, I'm having another big meal, and, you know, this time I'd like to borrow not just spoons, but some forks and knives also. And the guy's very happy to lend them to him, because he thinks, I don't know what's with this guy, but fine. And he lends him out, you know, full table settings, and the guy comes back, and he says to him, you know, afterwards, he says, I'm sorry, I have some terrible news. They died. The spoons, it was a plague, the whole thing, they all died. And the guy says to him, what are you talking about? Plates, they don't die. So he said, you believe me when I told you they gave birth? So this reminds me of here with our conversation about immersing them for their conversion. The food utensils should need conversion. The scissors for the wall doesn't need conversion. Why in the world should that be? Chuck writes in the chat, am I correct that new means those owned by Gentiles as opposed to new owned by Jews? query whether absorption has nothing to do with food. The answer is yes. Those that have been owned by non-Jews specifically, it has nothing to do with anything owned by Jews. In other words, if I knew that Jews had used the utensils they sold to me and used them for treif, I would need to kosher them, but I would have zero reason to tovel them. It's about the non-Jewish ownership that preceded mine. That's the sole factor. So, Jack, you're on mute.
What if you're not certain whether or not the Jews, they bought them from McCoy, and they may not have taken them to Mikvah?
Right, so we're going to get to that question. We're not there just yet. That's the next comment of Rav Nachman, so hang in there on that one. But I'm going to share the screen to show you Rashi. Rashi tries to explain what in the world Rav Nachman meant when he said, we're talking about clay seuda, specifically. Rashi is at the top of the page in the margin on the side there. It's the part where I have the arrow. Clay seuda amurim b'parsha. Dak siv, because the text says, kol davar asher yavo ba'esh, anything that goes through fire. Ve'ein derech lishtamesh al yidei ha'ur el ha'kelim shel tzarchei seuda. He says, what do you use with fire? Utensils that you're going to prepare food with. Other utensils don't normally get used with fire. Fire is used for cooking. And with those, it says, v'taher, which is for immersion. So Rashi says that Rav Nachman is getting the idea from the fact that it's normally used with fire. That's Rashi's take. The Rashba has a different view. And I believe I brought it on the source sheet. Let's see. Yeah. On the source sheet, it is source Hay. Scrolling up. Amar le'Rava klei seuda amurin b'parsha. He says, Klomar, midichsiv kol asher yavo ba'esh, because the text says anything that goes through the fire. Ve'ezu davar sheba ba'esh, what is it that comes through fire? Vitzarach lahachshiro ba'esh, and also needs to be kashered in fire. It's not just that it's something that we use with fire, but that it has a known heating process to purify it. Haviyom reizek klei seuda. That is klei seuda shebolaya al yidei ha'esh. It absorbs via fire. V'tzarech lahaflit bula'o al yidei ha'esh. And you also have to get rid of whatever was in it via fire. It has more of a fire relationship to it. That's the way that he takes it. The Pri Chadesh writing in Yerodea also sides with the Rashba. He says it has to be what the Rashba says, because if you took Rashi's approach, that it's just that these vessels are normally used with fire, there are other vessels that get used with fire, right? What about if I have, a poker that I use in the fireplace, right? That also gets used with fire. Maybe that has to go to mikvah also.
Weapons.
Sorry?
Or weapons.
Weapons. Okay, weapons would be another example. So he says, it isn't just that it's something that gets used with fire. It's something that has a cleansing process associated with fire as well. That's a stronger idea. Now, I didn't want to go into here the major question of what exactly qualifies as clay seuda. In other words, you're telling me meal items require toveling. There are items that are obviously meal items. I have a fork, a knife, a spoon, right, that I use at the table. Those presumably are meal items. What if I have something that's used with raw food and it's never going to be used at the table? It's something I use with raw food. Let's say I have a cleaver, right? I'm a butcher. I have a cleaver. Does a cleaver need koshering? It's not clay seuda, it's clay ochel. It's used with food, but it's not used with a meal at all. Right? What if I have a plate that the food gets put down on at the table, but the plate doesn't do anything, no one's eating with it, it's just protecting the tablecloth. Does that require toveling? So that's a nice long discussion, but I did want to show you one piece of it because I didn't want to ignore it entirely. So I brought you the Aruch HaShulchan. He's always good for this sort of thing. In source Vav, and I'm going to read it through quickly and translate as we go. He says the following. He says, "Belachein nira lafi ani yizdaiti." It appears in my humble opinion, the kavanas rabosenu, as far as what our sages meant. Divadei betashmish gamur shakli mishameshes lahaseuda. He says, if you're talking about something that's actually used for the meal, then it doesn't matter whether it's used with food that still needs some cooking as part of the cooking process, or whether you're dealing with end product food. He says, any utensil that's going to be used at the meal, whether the food is in the cooking process, whether the food's already done, whether the utensil is usable for something else, not usable for something else, needs immersion for sure with a bracha. Amnam, however, hakelim she'enam me'ikarei tzarchei ha'seuda, utensils that are not really of those that are needed for the meal, kolomar, meaning, and the part that I bolded, she'enam malim umoridim be'esek habishol v'ha'afia, they're not actually part of the process of cooking or baking, ela she'mitzad acher hutzrachnu l'malach hazu, but we need them for some other function in preparing the food. What could that be? What kind of utensil do I use to prepare food, but not for cooking, and not for baking? So he gives you some examples that I bulleted here. Om ibn ad-din. Sometimes you have a utensil that you need for halachic reasons. Kemo sakin shel shchita, like a shchita knife. So there, it's not a cooking thing. It's not used at the table, right? One would hope. However, it's part of the process of preparing the food. Or, mipnei derech eretz. Sometimes you need a utensil because it's gross not to have a utensil. He says, if you have sakin shel hefshet, if you have a special knife that you use to skin the animal, right? It doesn't go out to the table. It's not part of cooking it, but it's derech eretz to have, you know, that you remove the hide from the animal before you're going to eat it. It's gross not to do so. Or he gives you another example. Barzilim, pieces of iron, which are used with matzah. They're called in Yiddish shtoppel eisen. Anybody know what shtoppel eisen is?
Eisen means steel.
Yes. Yeah, what is shtoppel? So these are, I can't see everybody because I'm sharing the screen, so I don't know if anybody's answering. These are matzah poppers. Meaning that if the matzah starts to develop a bubble, they had a special tool that they used in order to pop the bubble. So that's that's also needed as part of your process, but it's not used for the meal. So he says all of these einami karim l'seuda, they're not essential to the meal. Vein srichlam kla, you don't need them at all. The gambel adam yisafel yispashel ketikuna, the food's going to be cooked either way. Lachain ein tzarech tevila, no need to tovel it. So he says, you don't tovel a shechita knife, you don't tovel your matzah poppers, these things don't require immersion, they are not called clay seuda. Clear? Okay. I want to do a couple of more lines in the Gemara here. We're doing a lot outside of the Gemara, but I want to make sure to see some Gemara as well. So we are at the second comment of Rav Nachman now. It's at the top. I just scrolled up. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rabba Baravua. Rav Nachman says, quoting Rabba Baravua, Lo shanu ela bilakuchin. He says, this rule that you have to tovel stuff is only if you buy the utensil. Ukamaisa shahaya, like what happened with Midyan, where you took possession of the utensils, right? You didn't buy it, you killed the Midianites. But the point is, you took possession. Avol she'ulin lo, however, if you borrow it from non-Jews, then you do not need to immerse it. That's his statement. Okay? Only that which you buy, that which you take possession, also if you receive it as a gift, if you take possession, now it is yours. So on this, Tosfos makes an important statement. Tosfos writes, Aval Sheulin Lo, at the top here, we have the big letters Aleph Beis Lamed Abal. Omer Rabbeinu Shmuel. Rabbeinu Shmuel, one of the authors of the Tosfos, says, Yisrael Shashal Klimi Yisrael Chaveiro Shekhaname Ove Kochavim. What if the following happened? I only borrowed the utensil. And this takes us back to Jack's question. I only borrowed the utensil. But I borrowed it from another Jew who bought it off of a non-Jew. So in other words, there was a Jew who bought the utensil off of a non-Jew and didn't take it to mikvah. He then lent it to me. So Kevin Shabal Yidei Chiyuv Tvila B'Yad Yisrael Rishon, since the first Jew, the one who bought it, had to tovel it and didn't do so, I am not allowed to use it without toveling it. You follow? If I borrow something from someone and it needs toveling, then I am going to be required to tovel it. Which leads to a classic halachic question, which is, what happens if I'm a guest in another Jew's home? And this person didn't tovel their kelim. Is there any reason why I would be obligated to tovel the kli? In other words, would I be prohibited from eating with those utensils since he did not immerse them? So that's a machlokas. That's a debate. But I brought you on your sheet, Sor Zion from Rav Moshe Feinstein. He said, the ha'ochel b'malon, if you eat in a malon, and for those who don't know what a malon is, Rav Moshe is always very helpful. In parentheses, he tells you a hatel. I'll make it easy for you. A hotel. If someone is eating in a hotel, open misada or a restaurant, uchdomet and the like, she'ein tovlin kleim, where they do not immerse their utensils. V'nasu lefanav chatichos basar, and they gave meat. They gave him meat. Uchdomet munacha, uchdomet and the like. Munachos agave kleim matzus as a chuchis, and it's on some metal thing or it's on something of glass. V'einan tzrichos le'etzem hakli. But you don't actually need whatever it's sitting on. The plate isn't really necessary for these items. You're not using it for eating. It's just to keep the tablecloth clean. I'm skipping that. His point is to say, he says, you would be allowed to eat with your hands. Or to use an implement that doesn't require toveling. That you would be allowed to do. So in other words, what Rav Moshe says is, technically speaking, I do need to tovel these things. I can get away without toveling the plate. Because the plate isn't really part of this, it's not really necessary for the meal. The fork, the knife, that I can't use. He holds that I will have an obligation to make sure to tovel or not use the non-toveled kalim. You follow? That's the idea. Now, this is hinting at a whole other conversation that we're not going into, which is the way the Torah frames the mitzvah of toveling, it's an active mitzvah. You should tovel your kalim. It doesn't say that if you didn't do so, and you prepared food with it, that the food is treif. Right? Nowhere did it say that the food is not kosher. So that's a discussion. If somebody actually prepares food using utensils that have not been toveled, and they put it out in front of me using utensils that have not been toveled, did that do anything to the food? Or can I say, as long as I now use toveled kalim to eat it, I'm okay? So that's a further discussion. That's not the Gemara's point right now. The Gemara is going to veer from this to talk instead about materials and which materials require toveling. That's going to be the next piece here. But something definitely worth discussion at some point. So to wrap up what we said almost everybody believes that toveling is de'oraisa. The Rashba thinks that the Rambam thinks it's de'rabanan. But the Aruch HaShulchan and others argue, the Rambam agrees, that fundamentally it's De'oraisa, it's biblical. And Rav Nachman gave us two ideas from Rabbah Bar Ravua. Number one, that this rule of tovling applies to clay seuda, Right? Because, either as Rashi said, because we talk about things that are passed through fire, and clay se'uda, meal things, are used with fire, or, as the Rashba took it further to say, it's because the Pasuk actually talks about that which is used with fire, but also something that has a kashering process through fire, which means things that are used with meals. And then last, toveling applies if you take ownership of the utensil, not if you're just borrowing it from the non-Jew. But once a Jew takes ownership, toveling is required, and therefore Tosfos says, even if he lends it to somebody else, that other person is going to need to tovel it, which leads to Rav Moshe's comments regarding the hotel. Clear?
What if he bought the from another Jew?
You would have to tovel it. That is correct. Yeah. Okay. Then thank you very much. I wish everybody a good and safe week. And 8 o'clock, God willing, next week. Yes, indeed. We made the formal declaration. The Ksubos is our next Masechta. It'll take us a little bit yet to get there. This is a packed daf we have left. Clive is laughing because Clive went through the daf Yomi cycle with me. And you need an hour and you're done. But nonetheless, we're going a little slower here. So yes, Ksuvos is, God willing, next. I forwarded around to you when Maury had sent me a link that Art Scroll had some big sale. So hopefully some people took advantage of that. But yeah, Ksuvos, God willing, is the next Masechta. Okay. You too.
Online.
I'm sorry?
Can you order an art scroll online?
I think so. Try it.
You can get it on Amazon.
Yeah. Amazon. It should be available.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, let's go to artscroll.com.
Yes. .ca, but yes.